This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia, the podcast where we visit with authors about their books and information located beyond the page. This episode features a conversation I had recently with Carlo Rovelli, an Italian theoretical physicist and writer who has worked in Italy, the United States, and France. His work is mainly in the field of quantum gravity, where he is among the founders of the loop quantum gravity theory. Now, if your eyes started to glaze over at that last statement, stick around. Rovelli is also the author of Seven Brief Lessons on Physics, lessons which were written for those who know little or nothing about modern science. The lessons initially ran as a series of articles which appeared in the Sunday supplement of an Italian newspaper. They were expanded and published in slim book form in more than 25 languages internationally. I caught up with Rovelli via Skype in Chile. Here's our conversation. In the preface of your book, you explained that these seven lessons were written for those who know little or nothing about modern science, and that they are actually expansions of a series of articles published in the Sunday supplement of an Italian newspaper. How were they received in that newspaper?
They were received very well, and this is why the publisher asked me to write this book. This book is not an idea of mine, it is an idea of the publisher. The articles on the newspaper were three. So it's not the book, it's just a core from which the book has later expanded. And they came out on three Sundays, one after the other one, and they were very much noticed and appreciated, and there was some talking in Italy about them, and people liked them. And then the publisher called me and said, why don't you do a book out of it? And I said, oh, come on, no, you don't do a book out of articles. A book is different. But then it's a very prestigious Italian publisher, and I was tempted by the idea of doing a short presentation of physics, and so I said yes.
I'm glad you did.
I am glad I did.
You mentioned that Einstein's general theory of relativity, which one physicist called the most beautiful of theories, was among the masterpieces that move us intensely. You described these masterpieces like Mozart's Requiem, Homer's Odyssey, the Sistine Chapel, and Shakespeare's King Lear as works that may require a long apprenticeship to appreciate their brilliance. Do these same masterpieces move you, or what would you include on your list?
Oh, definitely those ones. Certainly. The list is also a list of my passions in other fields. I am particularly moved by the classics, by the greatest work that everybody appreciates. So I'm not particularly original in my taste in literature, art. I like more things of the past that have been sort of selected for the value than recent things. And I do think that the emotion that masterpieces give you, whether it's music or sculpture or literature or poetry, and physics and science are similar, because in the moment in which you see something new to your eyes, is that they are both experiences that teach you how to view the world differently. If you read a great novel, then you look at humanity differently because you have a new perspective on it. And if you study Einstein, then you look at the world differently because you have a new perspective on it. And this is wonderful.
You wrote that in their articles and essays, Einstein and Darwin, they would use phrases like, it seems to me, or I think. You point out that genius hesitates. Why do you think that is?
Oh, I think it's true at all levels. I think that the people who are very sure of themselves usually are the people who are less intelligent and don't see the complexity of issues. And don't realize that they can be wrong. I think the more somebody's intelligent, the more sees how much we don't know about things and how much everything we do is uncertain. And also, science is not about rational deducing consequences from experiments or anything like that. Science is about trying to guess better how things are, and then of course test that and do experiments, and there's mathematics, there's rationality, there's logic, there's all that. But it's an exploration work. It's going into the darkness. And going into the darkness, you try, you say, well, I think things could be like that. And the big step ahead in science, I think, are done by people who know very well that they're taking a risk also in doing that, and it could be wrong. What they do could be wrong.
The book touches on, among many theories, the Big Bang Theory. And I was surprised to see in the second lesson on quanta, and I quote, "It's as if God had not designed reality with a line that was heavily scored, but just dotted it with a faint outline." And then in lesson 4 on particles, you wrote, "The beautiful theory, SU5, despite its considerable elegance, was not to the good Lord's liking." Does God, for you, play a role in any of these lessons?
No, not at all. not at all. And in fact, it's a little bit way of talking of physicists. I think it comes from Einstein. It was also there before. Many physicists who are atheists, I don't believe in God, use this way of talking. It's a gentle way of saying it's using God for nature or using nature for God. I don't know. You can read the way you like, because this is a personal take on things. But definitely none of these two quotes mean that I do think there is a personality or an intelligent who designs the way the world is. Physicists deal with the world and try to guess the ways of the world, the ways of nature, and often use this language, oh, God should not have liked that, so didn't do this way. It's always done with a smile, in a gentle way. It's not a strong, it's certainly not a theistic position, it's not a strong declaration of atheism either, it's a way of talking.
In the sixth lesson, Probability, Time, and the Heat of Black Holes, when talking about probable and improbable behavior, and specifically the behavior of a balloon when air is let out, you wrote, "It will be very improbable, for instance, that the balloon will fly out of the window, circle the lighthouse down there in the distance, and then return to land on my hand at the point where it was released." And as I was reading that, I was reminded of SpaceX, who last December landed a rocket upright on land, and then just 3 days ago landed a rocket upright on a drone ship. How does the improbable prediction of a balloon's behavior relate to the probable upright landing of a rocket?
Well, if there's something that looks improbable, like the rocket landing in that peculiar way, there should be a reason for that. That's one of the core assumptions of science. So distinguishing the events where there's a specific sequence of reasons giving one particular outcome from the ones in which we don't see any particular reasons for this or that to happen, it's a core part of the work of a scientist, of course. What is interesting is that all of our understanding of heat, of thermodynamics, of why things are cold or hot, and perhaps a good deal of our understanding of time, what time is related to carefully thinking precisely about that, when things happen randomly, when they don't happen randomly, and what does it mean for us to say that something happened randomly or not. And the sixth lecture, which I believe is the most difficult of the seven, the others are sort of easier to read, that one becomes more complicated because it deals with what is time and what is probability and what is the difference between what we know and what we guess about the world. This lecture goes exactly into these issues. It's a lecture where I hope not to lose the reader, because I think all the rest reads very easily. That one becomes a little bit more complicated.
Well, also in that chapter, speaking of time, you talked about time and space and compared the terms here and now. So if I'm standing,
yes,
if I'm standing on a sidewalk, my here is static, but the now has already moved past me. Do I exist in the here or the now?
Well, in our daily experience, here and now are very different, are extremely different, right? We can change place as at wish, but we cannot change time at wish. So time sort of seems to be changing by itself. We don't do anything. We don't step in time. But our daily experience is not the entire universe. We have a very limited experience, which is only at this particular scale, minutes, hours, maybe years, and some distance. We move very slowly. If we were much bigger, much slower, much smaller, if we could move much faster, our experience would be different. That's somehow the beauty of science, right? It's not something strange, right? It's like the Earth being round. We look around us and we don't see around Earth. If we lived in a very small planet, we would, but we live in a big planet. So we look around us and the Earth is flat. And it seems incredible that if we travel always in the same direction, we come back here. But we do. The Earth is round. So the world is different than what it looks like. And this difference is deep. And science is, physics in particular, is going to try to discover what is, how things are beyond our usual impressions. And if we do that about here and now, we discover that they are much more similar than what they look to us. And in a sense, they are the same thing. There is no precise now all over the universe. And then you have to read the book if you want to know more.
Okay. In your closing chapter, the seventh lesson titled Ourselves, you said, and I quote, "We belong to a short-lived genus of species." You also point out that we are the only species on Earth to be conscious of the inevitable mortality, but also that you fear that we will become the only species that will knowingly watch the coming of its demise. When do you think that will occur?
I hope it would not occur, and I've written this also in a little bit in a provocative way, as a way of saying careful. To some extent, it is in our hands. I do believe that the environmental risks, the global warming, and the other damages that we're doing to the planet are serious, are very serious. And I do think that if we do nothing, we are strongly threatening the life itself, our species, or at least our civilization. Many civilizations in the past have collapsed. It would not be the first one, our kingdom, to collapse. It's a way of saying, look, let's do something before it's too late. Having said so, I also think we should not be blinded by our love of ourselves and think that our species is immortal necessarily. It's not. Most species have a short life and then they disappear. And all the species similar to us have already disappeared. It's very possible that humanity will last for a while, and then that's it. It's not necessarily true that we will live for millennia and millennia, maybe move out of the Earth. It might be, but it might not be. But that's okay. We individuals have a finite life, and we species can have a finite life. And not for this. That's not a tragedy. That's reality. And I think life is beautiful because it's finite, because it is what it is. In fact, it's marvelous. It can be very hard, but it can also be wonderful, short as it is.
And it's breathtaking.
Yeah, I think this is the end of the book. I think the picture of reality we have is breathtaking, and that's what I try to say in the book.
That was Carlo Rovelli speaking about his book, Seven Brief Lessons on Physics, which was published by Riverhead Books. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens, our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.